All right, here we go again. We're back with another weekly dollop of Mint Sauce Chronicles. I hope everyone's in good health. The format, I'm going to say it this week, I haven't said it for about 4 or 5 weeks. I'm missing it. The format is simple. We release 4 shows a month. Members get full podcast plus download. Non-members get part one. That's at sheepfarm.co.uk if Chris can stop playing drums while I'm talking. All new shows are released on Saturdays. It's easy. Don't need an email, nothing. But if you want to subscribe to the website, you will get notification. We also release them on the first hour on Podomatic, and they send them out to Spotify, Amazon, Audible, Google, and Tapple, and a few others. And they're also on Rumble and on Odyssey. Did they say that already? Rumble and Odyssey. Anyway, Powerman's in there. I have said that, you know, Chris, because somebody said, how come I can't watch a full episode on YouTube?
It lasts about 3 seconds if tried to put on YouTube.
Well, I mean, some of them can go on. The Huxley stuff is all. It seemed to get away with stuff like that. The cultural stuff we seem to get away with. But these type of podcasts, I'm not even going to waste my time editing and pissing about trying to make them YouTube friendly. It'll take me hours. Thanks for the comments, emails, and direct messages to Chris's Instagram.
We're over 1,000 people on Instagram now.
He's well chuffed, he's got 1,000 friends.
Yeah. Get that little dopamine hit.
According to Dom Jolly, you're a cult leader.
Right.
Yeah, that's what it is. We're in a cult. Yeah, we're in a cult now.
I'm quite proud of that if we're a cult leader.
Yeah. Thanks for everyone who orders me vitamins and minerals and all that other stuff that's on there. I've got some new magnesium on there, actually. I've been taking that. That's really good. I've got some good results from that. But remember to use the promo code. It's in the description. Some people still order without putting the promo code in. Only you guys get that. It's sort of like wholesale prices. I also put in the email, the link for Richard D. Hall's donation button, if you want. I don't say it every week, but I have put that in there as well. Also, I'm putting together... me and Chris are going to record a bit more. A special live event video that we recorded on the 18th of May, the Sheep Farm Mark Devlin live event. We managed to get some really good audio recording on it. I cleaned it all up. We've got some video as well, but I'm not going to use all the video. It's because I'm going to do it as like a presentation like I normally do. I will add some of the video in. But we're also, I don't know what you call it, Chris. What do you do with extended, what do you say, extended remix? Yeah, Redux, the Redux or whatever. But I think that the actual video is 2 hours, or the presentation was 2 hours. But at the minute, with my own add-ons, before we start recording, it's gone up to 2 hours 40. So I reckon it'll be 4 hours. It'll probably be 2 shows split into two.
That'd be good. 12-inch remix.
Yeah, 12-inch remix. But like old days, 80s.
80s style.
Yeah. Soul to Soul, Back to Life, 12-inch remix.
Pasadena's Clapham Junction remix, I remember.
Yeah, yeah, riding on a train. Yeah. I used to have a Pasadena's haircut.
So did I, but mine were too curly.
Yeah, yeah, yours were a bit... they were a curly one, though. Pasadena's.
Yeah,
it was
actually.
They were a curly one. So that's about it, really. Don't need to go on about anything else there. All right, let's get on with the show. In this first part, we've got a special guest with us, James Dellingpole, is going to be joining us. And in the second part, in the members hour, we're going to be just chatting between me and Chris. All right, we've got a special guest with us today. Welcome to Sheep Farm Podcast, joining me and Chris. It's a bit early for him to be drinking his witch piss, as he's normally uncorking.
No, un café.
You've got a coffee today?
Yeah, it's blooming 12 o'clock, half 12.
What excuse? That's no excuse for you. Now it's happy hour on a Friday, isn't it?
No, I've got to have some reasoning for it.
So, well, right.
What have you got there, James? I thought you just had a bottle of champagne.
You've just mentioned James. You don't even know who he is yet.
don't give it away the secret.
It's too late now. The genie's out the bottle. Oh, the witch piss is out the bottle. We've got James Dellingpole with us anyway.
I'm drinking water out of a bottle. Do you know why? Because I'm at my brother's house, at Dick's house, and I'm in his shed at the bottom of his garden, and his house is locked. He's away somewhere. He's at lunch. He's coming back later on. I'm borrowing his shed, so I can't get into the house to make a cup of tea.
Did you break it? Have you broke into his shed?
Yeah.
Fantastic. That's what you do to brothers. Chris's shed's a bit different. If I broke into his shed, it's just full of pottery and weird faces and stuff like that. It's like getting into Hannibal Lecter's.
I've just been in there all morning. I love being in my shed. Yeah. It's a man's heaven.
I don't know if you know, he's a potter. He makes sculptures and stuff like that, does Chris?
Yeah.
Does he?
Yeah.
Do you, Chris?
Yeah, I'm
impressed.
Yeah.
Like Edmund Duval, that Japanese.
Not quite as good as that, I don't think. But I make weird sculptures, but I sell them on online. Yeah, I love doing it. I'm in my shed all the time.
the odd thing is, James, right, on our little farm that we lived on, my dad had this big shed in his thing that he made all sorts of stuff like garden sheds in, fencing and all, whatever he needed to make.
He's like woodwork, landscape gardening.
Yeah, now he's doing the same thing, but making pottery in his little shed. It's mad. And he wears a vest exactly like his dad and drinks a pot of tea.
I'd love to have some skills like that. I think we're going to need making skills for the coming apocalypse.
It's quite funny because I follow a few sculptors on Instagram, and when you see some of the talent out there, you know, I mean, we're going about old, you know, Renaissance sculpture and stuff, but some of the talent out there now, it's amazing, and it's almost, you don't see it on TV. It's not broadcasted that you know this talent exists. You know, they could be making little Batman or little blooming Lord of the Rings stuff, but it's still talent. It's still, it's still quite amazing what people can construct.
Every ancient talent, whether it's sewing, everyone's grandma used to knit stuff. Whether it's
metalwork.
They talk about sustainability, but they had it. They were sustainable. That's what how they used to live their lives. Everything got made into something, utilized, and now we have to raise billions of dollars to do it.
I remember, James, going to, you'll appreciate this, I remember going to the, because we had horses, going to the blacksmith and watching my horses get shod. How do they do it these days? Because is it still the old school anvil?
You still have farriers. Yeah. I mean, there's a farrier that comes in to do the horses where I go. I'm sure it's the same for everywhere else as well. But you're right, these old skills. But you know what I was thinking when you were saying about all these people, these talented potters and people. Are you familiar with Gray's Elegy in a Country Churchyard? So I had this hypochondriacal phase when I thought I had Alzheimer's or something. I mean, actually, it was more like it should be the Lyme disease. But
I was there as well. I've been there.
So I started learning poetry to train my brain.
Right.
And one of the poems I learned, which I still sort of pretty much remember, was Gray's Elegy in a Country Churchyard, which is quite long. But so Thomas Gray sits in a churchyard musing about mortality, and he thinks about the graves of all the kind of the sort of local peasants who lived and died sort of unacknowledged. Maybe they had their talents. Maybe they were really talented and they could have been somebody, but for circumstance, which meant they never. And there's a line in it, something like, "Full many a gem of purest ray serene, the dark unfathomed caves of ocean bare. Full many a flower is born to blush unseen and waste its sweetness on the desert air." So he goes on in this vein, you know, somebody might be a Milton, except they never got to be John Milton.
I would argue that the ones who got famous got chosen to be famous.
You see, that's the interesting question. So Gray went to Eton. Elegy in the Country Churchyard was absolutely, I don't know how you earned a living from being a poet in those days. I mean, or ever. But he was huge, and there was this poem. Yeah, once you've been down the rabbit holes that we've been down, once you know, like your deep dive into Aldous Huxley and stuff, you start thinking, is anyone we've heard of, can we trust? And yeah, you know, we know that Shakespeare, for example, wasn't Shakespeare. He was just a made up person.
He had the first jab, didn't he?
That's right, they
put on a pedestal for a reason, though. Like usually a lot of propaganda involved with those poets and actors in the old. Me and my missus went to an exhibition in museum here. I went to see William Blake exhibition, and obviously, you know, I was looking at it through slightly different eyes, but it just to me seemed like early propaganda. He was chosen to sell a narrative with his drawings and whatever it was. I couldn't really work it out, but it just seemed, why is he still super famous? Why are these?
Well, do you think those feet didn't in ancient times walk upon England's mountains green?
Possibly.
I mean, that's the apart from Tiger, that's the thing that everyone knows of Blake, you know, Jerusalem.
And that picture where he's pointing down, he's actually got a, I always thought he was touching something through a cloud, but he's actually got a square in his hand, like a square and compass. He's got a compass in his hand.
Oh, has he? Which
gives it a different, slightly different angle.
Yeah, well, that's a shame, because I was hoping. I really like the idea that Jesus actually did come to England, you know, with his uncle, Joseph of Arimathea.
Who knows? Who knows?
And went to Glastonbury. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, we don't know, do we?
Nobody knows.
No, yeah. No. Nobody knows.
I mean, near where I live here, there's the Gog Magog Hills, which is going to be one of the rumours. Was
you tried not to mention Cambridge, aren't you, Chris?
I did.
Somebody complained that he mentions Cambridge in every podcast.
He got away with it this time.
Yeah, I skipped it. But that's some people say that they're the ones that came over from Troy. I've read some else saying that they reckon that's where Troy was in the Gog Magog Hill.
Well, that would be good, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
If this was our story rather than just the ancient Greeks.
But if you go and if you look at how people wrote and spoke, I mean, I've got a lot of World War I diaries, and even the simple private used to write letters home, and you read their letters, and it were like nobody can write like that anymore. Even the, you know, it weren't the colonel or whatever writing home; it was the private in the trenches.
Even in my existence, I'm 50 now. I remember when I moved away from Yorkshire and I went to London. I've got letters still that my mates are a bunch of thugs. They still wrote we still wrote letters to each other, and it's bizarre to see now. You know, there's letters from
postcard or something like that.
Not even a letter. Yeah. And these are from like guys of 19 years old, before when phone calls were still expensive. There was no mobiles, and you wrote letters to each other. I lived in Greece for a time, and my mates used to write me letters, and I'd write them letters back. It's just totally gone
on them airmail, blue airmail. Things. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's how we communicated, and it's really so. I was the same. I've still got some of the letters, or my parents have the letters that I wrote from Africa.
Yeah.
On my gap year.
What's one of them, James? To us that were signing on.
I'm sorry.
It's all right. Don't worry about it.
but the things that we've lost because of these evil devices that the spy devices that they persuaded us to carry around with ourselves. You know, irradiating ourselves and letting them spy on us, killing us, and they've taken away all our brain cells. I mean,
it is. I know I've said this before on here. It's very frightening when you look around in a, you know, you can be sat anywhere and you look around how many people are just transfixed to the worst one I saw was when I was taking my child for swimming lessons. And all the parents all around the swimming pools, and the kids are like, oh, "Look at me, mummy!" And everyone's just trying to transfix.
To be fair, taking your kids swimming is really, really boring.
It is really boring.
Yeah.
You don't want to be looking at them. They just like,
"Look at me! I'm swimming. Oh, great! That's all right."
I took a book. I've still got a burner phone, James, which Dom gets angry with me about because he says it's got really bad reception on it. So
does it? They can't spy on you through it.
Well, I'm guessing they probably can if they want.
I'm from the telecoms world. Everything's open.
To be honest with James, it's more because I get as hooked on them as anybody. It's more that I just don't want my face glued to it all the time.
Well, that's when it comes back to this, where you know it's a bad because people are saying, I need to come off Instagram. I need to come off Facebook. I need to stop using that. You know they're addicted to it because that's what people say about going out too much drinking or going out, whatever, partying too much.
A young lad said it to me at work the other day, Dom. He said, I've had to put Instagram down. I've come off it. I'm like, how much were you on it? Because, I mean, I'm on it. I mean, I go on it infrequently. And he said hours and hours a day. Just
fortunately, not on any social media, fortunately.
He said, I'm only on it for my sculptures and for sheep farms, to be fair.
Yeah.
But... Yeah, he said he had to come off it.
But they'll always find a way of getting you. So recently, I had a go at Duolingo to learn some Russian, and then I moved on to Spanish because I was going off to Colombia, and I thought it'd be more useful speaking Spanish than Russian in Colombia.
Yeah.
I go to see a trainer once a week, and my trainer is keen to get me on a fitness program. So how does he give me his fitness program? He doesn't say, here's a bit of paper I've drawn out with these. He says, here's an app and you just follow this app. So it's another way they've got you committed to this phone. Or when I'm driving, I listen to podcasts. How do I listen to the podcasts? I listen to them on my mobile device. So you try and escape.
Yeah. They've got you. There's no. I wanted to enroll my daughter for a piano lessons, right? And this woman wrote an email, and I went follow this link, and for the life of me, I could not sign her up for a piano lesson. So I emailed this woman, and she said, "Oh yeah, it can be a bit confusing. Follow this link." I'm tapping out. I'm out. Yeah. I'm gonna have to
Can't I just come and see
it.
You? Give you some money.
Can't you just book it? Tell me how much it is, and I'll pay it.
Yeah, isn't that how it used to work? I mean, you rang them up. When are you free? Yeah. I'll come. What's the address? Okay, write it on a bit of paper.
Yeah.
It can be difficult. Follow this other link instead.
Do you know what? Some of it makes life easier. We're doing now makes life easier. We wouldn't be able to do the podcasts we do if we didn't have this technology.
Off, yeah.
You know, we can't be total Luddite, right? However, when it's being used, right? My wife were a bit flabbergasted because I do tell her research and she's into this side of the stuff, but she don't want to look at it too much. But she was saying I was talking to her about the technologies that we use. And how infiltrated they are by intelligence agencies. And I said, for instance, Jeff Bezos's grandfather, Lawrence Gise, was one of the co-founders of DARPA. Fuck, yes. So when you now thinking of Jeff Bezos, that he set a bookshop, online bookshop, in his garage or whatever they tell you this bullshit.
Yeah, that's
about
how it happened. Yep.
Yeah. his grandfather was a director of the US Atomic Energy Commission, and he was part of ARPA, right? Which was the forerunner to DARPA that him and another guy set up. And ARPANET was the first internet in the 60s, 70s, right? So now we know why Jeff Bezos has been utilized in that. DARPA had all the technology for Facebook because they had a system called LifeLog, which then turned into Facebook. They closed LifeLog down on February 3rd, 2004, and Facebook was incorporated on February the 4th, 2004, with Zuckerberg in place at Harvard. What I'm trying to say is, and I'm skipping over things, there are a deeper stories to all this. And then you've got all the other type, like Oracle, you know, Oracle, the CIA. Basically set up by the CIA. It's Oracle's first customer, Larry Ellison's first customer, Oracle, was the CIA.
Yeah. It's why they need these fake origin story movies like The Social Network.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, we're gonna get it. Who was the director? I mean, it's one of my son's a complete movie buff, and it's one of his favorites.
And so he should be at that age.
Okay. But
yeah, it was a Fight Club director on it, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so you need this story that, oh yeah, Mark Zuckerberg is just in his
flip flops in a bloody
in
hoodie,
a Harvard. That's how it happened. Because if any of us had kind of techie skills and had been working on our uni, we'd never have got it because we weren't the right families.
No. Again, Bill Gates, all the information that Gates and the Apple guy. Got to start Apple up, Steve Jobs, all came from the military. We're all military technology from ARPA, right? That was passed to IBM. IBM, the Bill Gates' mother, Mary Gates, was the one of the close family relations is with the CEO of IBM at that particular time that passed a lot of the information onto Apple and to Microsoft, which is why they both grew at the same time. You know, you needed that dynamic of, you know, that's for that and that's for that and Microsoft is this and Apple is that. And look where they are now. Look at these companies. They're basically $1 trillion companies controlling the whole world, all these companies. I mean, we've only mentioned four. You know,
did I get this from you, by the way? You know why open the pod bay door, Hal? The computer in 2001 is called Hal.
Right.
No, you didn't get that.
It's IBM transposed one letter up the alphabet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Paris, yeah, I did know that.
Yeah.
But David Fincher, incidentally, was the director.
That's it, yeah.
But interestingly, just as a side note, he just did a film on Netflix called Hitman. And it's got, I've forgotten his name, but it's got that actor in. English actor.
You need to start reciting poetry.
It'll come to me.
To remember stuff.
He basically plays a hitman. You know, the main protagonist is a hitman. You know, so it's he's already a horrible character who just goes around killing people, but he's the hero. But right at the beginning, when he's lining up his rifle, he says a quote, a Crowley quote, shall be the whole of the law. Do as thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. And then he says, interestingly, some guy said that. I can't remember who it was. That's what he says.
Really?
Just
clever script writing, Chris, isn't it?
Just, that is
clever script writing.
Just a little nuance in there. But me and my missus watched the whole film, and again, yeah, just horrible character, going around killing people for selfish reasons, but he's the hero of the whole.
I don't know if you've heard some of the latest stuff that we've done. We've been collecting these individuals that seem to be either related to or involved in basically actors that are assassins. All right, so you've obviously got the most famous one, John Wilkes Booth. They were all actors struck assassins. Well, John Wilkes Booth is related to Sherry Booth, Sherry Blair, right? A direct descendant, right? Yeah, I know, mentally. And then you've got, say, William Shepard, is it, the first man in space, who's a direct descendant of Jeffrey Dahmer and John Wayne Gacy. Then you've got Kevin Bacon and Kyra Sedgwick, who are married. They're something like ninth cousins, and they're direct descendant of John Hinckley Jr., who shot Reagan. So we're collecting all these people all of a sudden. So we started on the Nolan brothers, didn't we, Chris? You know, the Batman guy, Christopher Nolan. Yeah. We've just done Oppenheimer. So we did a bit of a breakdown on Oppenheimer with some of the cast. But what came out of that was his brother. His older brother, the third brother, he was wanted in Costa Rica for killing someone, assassinating someone in 2003/4. And under a pseudonym he used was Matthew Oppenheimer, 20 years before his brother made the film Oppenheimer. And there's an extradition, I've seen the extradition court papers that... we've got a list of about 10 people now that are direct linked to either assassins or of actors, famous people.
This was never meant to be uncovered. You're not going to last much longer.
It's fucking mental. I mean, it's quite interesting. I do find it interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Actors and politicians, down to serial killers and assassins.
Yeah, there's but a lot would of it surprise you because difference.
It's the same. But when you look at, say, Tom Hanks, for argument's sake, in front of the camera in 2020, telling everybody to do as they're told, or George Clooney, or these people who have actually worked with the CIA, does it really surprise you? What are the CIA? That they're an assassination and a mind control operation, basically, and they've got these actors in place that are mind control experts, because they're just an actor's basically a liar, which is mind control.
It's actually quite funny when you think about it. I never actually thought about this before, but Hollywood's obsession with assassins as well, as well as serial killers, but hitmen. We don't know any hitmen, but there's a film about a hitman every other week, isn't there?
There is, and hit girls.
Yeah, hit girls.
Yeah, hit girls as well, yeah.
Jolene Brad Pitt, weren't they hitmen? Mr. and Mrs. Smith,
yeah,
were it?
Mrs. Yeah, Smith, yeah.
Well, they've gone forever, hitman films, when you think about it.
I was going to say, she's well dodgy, but then he is too. They all are. I saw somebody did a deep dive on George Clooney the other day. Was that you?
We did one anyway. I'm just going to release one.
I was just going to mention him, because he also brought out that film, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, which was about that TV talk. No, he was a quiz show guy who, in his book, he confessed he was an assassin. Well, he said
that was another one on the list, wasn't it, that you mentioned? Yeah, yeah.
He said he was a CIA assassin, but he was the one who brought in numerous quiz shows in America. And the CIA denounced and said, no, he wasn't. He never worked for us ever. But he said in his autobiography.
That's the thing. Again, if the three of us were the most brilliantly talented actors ever, we could speak in iambic pentameters and just emote, we could be anyone. We'd still never make it because we haven't had the MK Ultra phase of our life. We haven't got CIA connections or MI5 connections. So we'd be toast.
Yeah. Well, we just wouldn't get past. You get to a certain point. I noticed in business, you get to a certain point, but unless you go to the next part, maybe joining the Masons with a compass and all, whatever you have to do, and the goat hind legs and all that type of thing. But you never get past that base unless you join. But you're never in, are you? You're never quite. People will never get in because you're not. You're always under the ceiling, under the glass ceiling, whether you like
some,
it or not.
I think some do get through. I think you can say the same for politicians and for actors. You see some that just
same
never
thing,
seems,
really.
Yeah, it is. What it is. You see some that just never seem to get there fully, do they? They get like halfway there. And then others, they seem to get there when they're absolutely disliked and of no use to anybody. Same with actors and politicians. I think you see the same thing happen.
I would say they have a layer of people who get to a certain point to hide the ones that are the chosen ones, person. That's where I would say. You've got people who start off in, say, politics with all the best intentions. They're going to change the world and et cetera, et cetera. And then along the way, they just get compromised, and it's too late. They can't back out. A bit like Godfather, if you like. It's a similar sort of principle.
Anyway, let's ask James what's been on your radar lately, James, of stuff.
Well,
me and my brother are blabbing on.
Well, actually, your brother mentioned before we started that he wanted to talk about watermelons.
That's right,
which
which
is a book I read.
Because she loves watermelons.
Yeah. It's a name I got called at school.
That big juicy watermelon.
Yeah, watermelon.
Well, we were lamenting, weren't we, the fact that teachers just are so PC now. They won't make racist jokes at the expense of their pupils or anything.
No. They won't make any jokes of anything.
I have to tell you one of my favourites of recent times. I've probably said this on here before, James. I work in a kitchen, and one of the young girls walked in and went, "Is that a new browner? Because we these cakes, as in cakes." And I went, "What are you on about? I've been here for 2 years." She didn't laugh, right? And she literally moonwalks out the kitchen, just staring at me with big eyes, like, "I don't know what to do about that comment at all."
If I go to sometimes if I go to a coffee shop, I'll say, "Can I have an Americano, please?" And it's black. And I said, "No need to be like that." What?
Yeah, I use that one. Actually.
Yeah.
I bet they're traumatized when you do.
100%. Yeah, 100%. Yeah,
no one knows what to say. And the funniest thing is if I get a bit of sun, because me and Adam go brown really easy, obviously. The older end will go, "God, you're brown." You know, "I've just been on holiday or whatever." The younger end just look at like double take you and stare at you like. Almost suspicious as to what's
almost thinking that ain't really Christian. And then they recognise your nostrils.
But they want to say you're browner than, but they don't say it. They actually don't say, you've got a tan.
That's a generational thing. You see, I'd be completely upfront about it.
Where have you been? Or something like that. That was a normal response.
I'm trying to resurrect the old, the bygone times where...
One of the guys I work with, he says, "I love working with Chris. It's like working with someone in 80s. Go on, sorry, watermelons anyway.
I asked
James, I said, he wrote a book pre-2020, a long time ago, in the mid-2010s, weren't it? If I'm right.
Yeah, it was. I think it was published in about 20... I did a kind of sort of private version, which came out in about 2011.
Right.
And then
there
was a sort of bigger one that came out in 2012.
So we're talking 13, 14 years ago.
Yeah.
Called Watermelons. It was about climate change.
All right.
Go on. Tell the story.
I'll tell you the interesting thing about it. I only stopped being a normie, I would say. I mean, I hate that word, but, for want of a better one. In about 2020, my down the rabbit hole moment was a combination of the Trump, an incontinent buffoon, coming into power, beating the most popular president, and the whole COVID nonsense and from that point on, I just went on this kamikaze dive down to the deepest recesses of the rabbit hole. Before that, I was reasonably house trained, apart from one thing, which is that I was probably one of very few people in the mainstream media who called out the climate change bollocks narrative.
Yeah. Global climate warming change.
Yeah, exactly. And I was, I just thought this is a great story, and why isn't everyone else covering it? Because there's so much evidence that climate change. The narrative is bollocks, and people were trying to warn me off, saying, well, the experts say, James, I know a climate scientist at the University of East Anglia, and I can tell you, he's really worried. You get all this stuff, and people would say, you know, it's not going to be good for your career and stuff. And I thought, well, yeah, but hey, I'm a journalist. It's what we journalists do. We speak, you know, because I believed in those days. I genuinely believe that's what journalists were supposed to do. They were supposed to find out stories that the government didn't want you to find out. I had no idea that they were basically paid stooges for this or that institution, be it MI5 or CIA or you know, Mossad or whatever. So I wrote this book and it was a huge bestseller, as of course, it wasn't. I mean, you know,
which publisher took it?
Well, it ended up in the UK being published by Biteback,
right,
which is a sort of a political bookseller run by Ian Dale.
Right. I'm sure I've heard that name somewhere. Anyway, go on.
Yeah. I mean, if you know their name, they're in the game. I did. He's another. He's one. Yeah, you know, they all are. Yeah. I wasn't. I'm not. And I wasn't then. I was like an idiot. I had no idea that my job was to advance the agenda of the deep state.
Cover everything up, basically. Yeah.
So I wrote this book and it all started. I really totally fucking hated wind turbines, wind farms. They just struck me. There was something evil about them in every way. There's a picture I refer to in actually my, I've just written an introductory essay to my revised version. There's a painting by Bruegel called The Triumph of Death. And on the hills in the background are all these gibbets sticking out, and I whenever I look at a wind turbine, I think of the gibbets in the Triumph of Death. They're horrible. They've got no place. The idea that they call these things farms. A farm is a.
They remind me of the Triffids. I don't know why.
Triffids or tripods. Do you remember that
tripods,
book?
Tripods.
That I knew they were evil, but I didn't know why they were evil. That was my starting point. And then there were books like Bjorn Lomborg, the skeptical environmentalist, which started calling into saying, hang on a second, he came up with these statistics like more birds are killed every day flying into plate glass windows or eaten by cats than were killed by the Exxon Valdez disaster, you know, which we're encouraged to believe was. So I started uncovering all these interesting facts about the climate alarmism that we're being sold compared to the reality. And I then started asking the question, if they are making this shit up, what's the motivation? Is it money? Is it power? Is it whatever? And there was a stage in the book, about three chapters, where I actually answered my own question. And I discovered things like the Club of Rome. The Club of Rome, which I now... So the Club of Rome was set up by a guy called Aurelio Pecci and another guy. But what I didn't do is dig deep enough. If you'd been doing this, you'd have dug deeper. And who is Aurelio Pecci? Who runs Aurelio Pecci? Well, he is in turn the tool of Gianni Agnelli, the guy who owns Fiat, and probably there's somebody even higher up. But we know about the bloodline families. We know about the
especially the Roman the papal, abilities and stuff.
The papal bloodlines, who are supposed to be even more powerful than the. So what you've got is this environmental body, a bit like Bilderberg, a bit like Club of Rome. You know, this shadowy organization which meets to plot how we're going to push the climate agenda. We're going to pretend it's a climate crisis because this isn't going to end. You know, they're upfront about it in some of their writings. So I knew about the Club of Rome, and I knew that there were these incredibly rich people who were lying about climate change because they were Malthusians. They believed that the planet was overpopulated. They wanted to reduce the population. They wanted to exterminate us all. They're liars, they're cheats. So I got all this. But 12 years ago, I didn't believe my own research. I kind of thought, they're saying this stuff, but it's not really real.
Well, just change it. Just to interject, I've just checked my notes because I did do some stuff on the Club of Rome. And it was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation.
Yes.
That's who funded it.
Okay.
Yeah.
You've got it. That was the, so you asked me before we started, what were the things that I would have changed about the book? You know, what
Yeah.
I was a different person then. For example, there's one stage in the book where I go, of course, I'm not one of those crazy conspiracy theorists who thinks that Diana was assassinated in the tunnel as part of a satanic love ritual.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm not one of those. No, don't, yeah. But
you
this
were.
isn't like one of those crazy conspiracy. Yeah. This is real. Of course, now I'm totally on board with the idea that Diana was assassinated.
Yeah, but do you know the irony behind that is that you actually, I know you know this, but you actually were, because although you're saying you weren't, that's the indoctrination part kicking in, isn't it? Because we all want to be part of humanity and get along and all this.
Mm.
But in reality, you'd uncovered and unearthed something that was
quite
well, huge.
massive.
Yeah, huge.
It was,
significant.
I mean, I did pick a big one. I mean, I think it's actually way bigger than 9/11 or in terms
Or
of.
COVID. It's bigger than all of them.
Yeah.
It's the thing that they're going to run. And the limits to growth was the blueprint for basically what the Club of Rome launched on.
That's
And those
right.
professors that launched that, they're basically telling you right out from the gates that they're going to reduce population.
And they've been planning it, as you say, for so long. This okay. So so one thing I said the conspiracy theory stuff because I was trying to get the reader on board, the mainstream reader. I was saying, look, this is really important, and don't dismiss me as a crank because this stuff is real.
But I think it's an honest thing that, you know, you were writing something realistically there, you know. You were hopefully getting people on board and not diverting them away, scaring them off.
I still listen to people. No, sorry, I was just going to say, I still listen to people, you know, doctors and stuff, but they're still on board that that COVID was already, they've accepted that the jib-jab's killing and hurting people, but they still believe in a lot of the COVID story. It's still interesting to listen to these people.
They still think Paul McCartney is alive. Lol.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, James. Sorry, mate.
Stuff like that.
As you know, I love interruptions and digressions.
Yeah.
So, okay. So one of the things one of the cringe things about the book I wrote, which is, you know, pretty good. One of the cringe things is me not realizing that everything, that all the conspiracy theories are real, not just the global warming one. But the another of the missing things that I think is absolutely key is the involvement, as you say, of the Rockefellers. And so many of the really bad things that are happening in the world can be traced back to that family. Now, whether you could argue that maybe the Rockefellers are just the bag men of the Rothschilds, but I don't know. I mean, that gets complicated.
But the guy they used in this, it was a guy called Maurice Strong.
Maurice Strong, yeah.
He was the guy that they, but he was an oil man, and he was the guy that they utilized to push all this agenda with the Club of Rome. I think he was involved in the Club of Rome quite early.
Maurice Strong was the guy who set up the Rio Earth Summit.
That's correct. Yes.
So he was very closely. He was a UN apparatchik. Mm. He was also in with China quite a lot, which shows how.
With Kissinger, yeah, it was, because obviously Kissinger was a Rockefeller man. It's all intertwined, isn't it?
It's all intertwined.
He was a Nixon man and all this type of stuff. It's.
Maurice Strong, yeah, the Rio Earth Summit, which was the one that really put everything. I mean, that was the launch of Agenda 21, for example, happened in the Rio Earth Summit. It was the moment where the whole climate change thing went really big in the newspaper, and delegations flew out there and stuff and yada yada yada. But the Rockefellers had been planning this since at least the 1940s, because so I think what people don't understand. This is why I get pissed off, is that the word, with people like Toby Young, who are still sort of fighting the same, you know, pretending it's about the science. It was never about the science. It's not about. So in the 1940s, the Rockefeller family, the descendants of the original evil lizard creature Rockefeller, we've got lots of money. We want to make even more lots of money, and we want to make sure, even more, I think, because we're bastards, we want to make sure that nobody else has money. You know, that's what they really want. They don't want any other companies to make it. So they ask themselves, what can we do to create the world, create a world in which our businesses thrive and everyone else's suffers? So they start coming up with this wish list of things that they need to promote, and one of them is the idea that that climate is a problem, and that because climate has no borders, you see, the environment has no borders. So if we can bolster supranational organizations like the World Health Organization, like the eventually to be created IPCC, and so on. If we can get international bodies creating international regulations, that will make it much harder for smaller individual businesses in individual sovereign states to do that.
Look what they set up, James. They set up in going back to 1940s or post World War II. They set up the UN, didn't they? The UN, the United Nations, is the forerunner to all this
stuff. It's a Rockefeller
baby. Yeah, yeah. Well, they actually gave them the land for the building. They built the building. So it is a Rockefeller baby. Now, whoever's behind the Rockefellers is sort of irrelevant. They're the front men, the bag men for whatever the New World Order is.
In the UN building, like a Tower of Babel, isn't it, I believe.
Is it Tower of Babel?
One of them.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's definitely the symbolism. So they own the UN, which means they own the World Health Organization. They also, I mean, simultaneously, when they were planning the climate change scam, they were also planning the whole vaccine scam, the whole health scam, because they bought up academe, they bought up the medical establishment, they bought up the newspapers, because they realized that reality might be a problem, the truth might be a problem. So they had to rewrite the truth. And planning this in the 1940s. So then you move forward and you get the Brundtland Commission and you get the Club of Rome, and it's no wonder we're in such a mess now.
No, well, we're in a mess. They're not in a mess. That's the truth of it all, isn't it? People say, oh, it's all breaking down. The plan's working fine. It's just not our plan.
that's one of the things I take issue with the people who say, a lot of people use this cope where they say, look, you know, people can't plan these things that in that minute detail. The world is chaotic. Nobody could do this. Nobody could be this competent. But actually, they are this competent.
From a psychology point of view, they know how people think. And with the stuff, the technology we're talking about now, they can control, as we saw in 2020, when the best part of the population were out on the doorstep banging pots and pans, adhering to what they were saying. That was a measurement of social contagion. That was them saying, look at what we can do. We know this plan can move forward because 90% of the population are outside banging pots and pans.
In the same way, that social media that we were decrying earlier, that's their, I mean, Mori polls are all fake.
It's a data gathering device.
Data gathering. They know, they're looking at the moment, they're looking at Twitter and so on, or Instagram or whatever, and working out, is this younger generation ready to be sent into the meat grinder in Ukraine, or are they going to resist? That's what they're trying to work out right now.
Well, Elon Musk bought that because he's let everybody, you know, he's opening up the doors for truth, isn't he, Elon Musk?
They only have to put a news feed story out there, and I'm guessing they can instantly grasp the data.
Yes,
and the whole world's populace's opinion on, like you said, about the, you know, signing up your kids for some bogus war. They can test that reaction immediately, can't they?
Yeah.
Well, the new Hunger Games. Yeah.
Then decide the which direction thing, to go in. Which way
just to complete the Waterman's thing, while I still remember it. The other thing that I didn't take these guys seriously enough. I thought that we had an element of choice in it. I didn't realize how controlled everything was. And the other thing I missed was weather manipulation, chemtrails and stuff. There really is man-made global warming or global cooling or whatever. And it literally is man-made by
climate
HAARP.
Change. Yeah, man-made climate change. By HAARP, chemtrails, whatever it's by.
But they're just pointing the finger at us.
Geoengineering, whatever they want to call it.
You both know, because this is how they roll. They like to mock us. They like they're into inversion. So they're into, so for example, their genius move with the environmental movement is to create a movement called environmentalism, which is actually about destroying the environment wholesale.
Yeah.
You know, ruining every hilltop with wind turbines, chopping down rainforests to build up palm oil. You know, the list
is everything. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It is. It's basically to control every inch of whatever it is we're living on. Including the air, including the water. That's why everything's been privatized. You know, the water were privatized. That should be free to everybody to drink clean water in this country where it rains all the time. We're now being scared with drought. I mean, we covered this 2 years ago when there was the wettest drought ever in history in Britain. But they always say since records began, James, and that was the mid-1850s. When obviously there was some sort of line in the sand that said, this is where history starts from now on in. Dinosaurs, et cetera, all start from this point onwards.
Well, that one I told you the other day, Dom, someone sent me, I think it was Johnny Fox sent me, and it was a news, I think it was GMTV, and they were saying that May was the hottest summer, the hottest May we've had since records began, et cetera. And they had the actual weather woman there saying, you might not think it was the hottest, but in the
evening, I mean, this is straight out of some Orwellian book, isn't it? You know,
but the evenings were warmer than any other May. So then, as a total, that makes it the warmest May. So don't trust your instincts, you idiot.
Yeah,
it was the warmest.
You might smell bullshit, but it's really roses.
Even though you pissed it down and you got your heating on in June, it's the coldest period of time.
I think if they're called the Met Office, they're going to know better than you. They've got degrees in meteorology, for goodness sake. What, have you got a meteorology degree?
No. Suppose I should just listen then, shouldn't I?
Yeah, you should just listen. Soak it all in, bang your pots and pans.
Must be my imagination that turned me heating on in May. Yeah.
It is extraordinary, isn't it? That I mean, they really have reached the phase now where they really don't care that we can see they're taking the piss.
No.
Yeah.
Whether they care, I actually think that
no one's going to move now, are they? If they believed it, you know, if they still believe
it's become the problem with the lie is it becomes, especially for people listening, people like us, it becomes more and more obvious. Yeah, because you've got to lie even more to cover up the lies. Because the truth is there. I mean, for her to say that on a script, that means newsreaders or weather people around Britain in the local stations and all that were all saying the same script. You might not believe
it.
She was probably questioning it herself.
Yeah.
Because she's thinking, well, no, it's been cold at home, but I am going to say this, you know. So basically, they changed the way they add up the weather.
Keep this cushy job.
Yeah.
Well, this is where I've got this theory about lying. And I'm sure I've mentioned this on a podcast before that when I was a child, I found myself incapable of lying pretty much because I thought that people could see inside my head and knew what I was thinking.
Yeah.
So there was no point lying. So I've always been, I mean, I obviously tell the occasional fib, but generally I haven't lied because I thought I could never get away with it.
Yeah.
And there are those who say, people who are into kind of supernatural things, that every time you tell a lie, you cause a sort of a glitch in a
disturbance, if you like.
Yeah, a disturbance. Yeah. And I think there's some truth in this, that every day people lie, and every lie makes the world a worse place. Whether it's a news reader reading out a story that she knows to be untrue, or a Met Office person just making up the shit up in the first place, or changing the, everyone is complicit. This is the thing. People think, oh, it's just the bad people doing this stuff, but it's not. It's pretty much everybody.
But that's how they compromise us all, isn't it? By getting us to tell these lies to keep his job, to pay his mortgage, to do this, yada yada. They compromise everybody, and now you've got leaders in power. I'm sure they've always lied, but even the most obvious one, Margaret Thatcher, General Belgrano, Tony Blair, 45-minute bloody weapons of mass destruction, Boris Johnson, Cameron, all these people have lied, right? Yet people still vote them in. Look at Keir Starmer now, Keir Starling, right? A sneer Starling. I mean, he's been proven to be as big a liar as Boris Johnson. I mean, I did put a few videos together and I'm saying, interviewed a few years ago, Jeremy Corbyn's one of my best friends. And then the next interview, are you and Jeremy Corbyn still friends? No. So it changes. But yet people now thinking he's going to be the new saviour. And they're bought into this, that lying is good, basically. You can lie your way through. It's all right. It's only a little lie. But going back to what you said, there's a little bit of your soul being chopped off every time you do it or cut away when you sign that Rumpelstiltskin contract.
Yeah. I think it's scary. And of course, if everyone started telling the truth, I mean, not like in the Ricky Gervais movie, but if everyone's, I mean, their game would be over just like that.
Yes. One thing I find strange is I used to watch a bit of news objectively, you know, just to catch up on it. I try and put it on now, sometimes in the morning, just to catch the headlines, maybe for me and Dom are doing a minute on, just see what shite they're talking about. And it actually makes you feel uneasy.
Ill. I can't watch it. It makes you feel ill.
You can take it for a little while. You have to switch it off. You can't sit there with it on in the background. I can't personally, anyway. I can't sit there with it in the background.
Watch any mainstream TV anymore.
It's just bizarre. It makes you feel a bit uneasy, I think.
Yeah, and yet so many people have the news on when you go around to their... I mean, when I go around to my mother's house, you know, she's got the TV on. If it's not the golf or the tennis, it'll be the news.
Rolling news. Yeah.
Casting spells into that living room 24/7 all the time. So there were a few things we sort of wrote down. One thing I want to cover is, last time, apparently, we were talking on when we did the podcast on your show, some people said when we were asking you about certain things, we were taking the piss. And I know you didn't think that, but we weren't. We wouldn't be sat here now if we were just
taking a piss
take,
about,
you know?
What? For?
I know. Do you know what? I tell you what I think it is. I think what it is there are some people who haven't let go of the class thing.
Yes,
I mean,
I've
completely given up on class bollocks. Because I know that it's just another invention of theirs to try and divide us. But I think some people say, "Oh, these Northerners, you know, they've got James's. Yeah, they can't help it. They've got James's measure."
Absolutely nonsense. No, it's you know, I get on with people.
Yeah,
that's it. If 2020 has learnt us anything, you get on with people, because you need to, because we're only a small group of people. We're a minority.
I was talking about this yesterday, actually. I went down to Clive de Carle's for a delicious, the best burgers I've ever eaten. And there was a as you'd expect at Clive's, there was a complete sort of a hippie assemblage of, you know, some people come up from Glastonbury and stuff. And I could say what I liked, because I was with the home team. And I was just remembering how great it was on the marches, where the mix of classes and races and religions was total. But what was really interesting for me was that the black people on the marches, for example, would you'd never find them playing the race card or trying to sort of like, I'm black, I'm a bit special, you know, you've got to give me some spec. It was like all the bullshit was stripped away, and everyone was the same.
Yes, it didn't matter, and that's how it should be, you know.
Totally.
That is how it should be.
It's how it's going to be when Christ returns. We're all going to kind of live in, you know, that's how it'll be.
Or we'll be living in District 13 from the Hunger Games.
I've been to District 13 in Medellin in Colombia.
Right.
And I have to say, the EMF is off the scale. The wires and the...
Yeah.
I had to get out.
Yeah.
Never mind the, you know, the knives. Actually, all the knives have gone. It's a tourist attraction, but yeah.
So I want to get that off the slate that we were taking.
It's gone.
I'm not aware of that fact. I don't know what you're...
It could just be two people in my Telegram group. So I mean,
but anyway, the fact is, right, a lot of the research that we do, because it brings up schools, probably similar schools to where you went. And that doesn't mean to say I'm a stupid northern bastard that thinks everybody who went to them schools actually was part of MI5 or went on to be prime minister, because that's just nonsense. Yeah. What I'm saying is they are elite schools, we've got to say that. And I think there is a place for that type of thing, because you need people, if it was used right, used not for nefarious reasons, it would be the ideal place. But the problem is, we're bred to compete with each other and fight each other. And so they're never used for right things, are they? Or very rarely, anyway. But most of these characters that we speak about, whether it's Orwell, we're going to talk about C.S. Lewis in a moment, but all these people, seem to be, now I bet 90% of them come from those schools.
Well, probably because traditionally, I mean, that's what they were created for, wasn't it? They were created to train people to run the empire.
Yes.
And stuff like that.
Yes. So I actually read something the other day that I've done some research on Dom Joly because he seems to have really risen to the surface. He's doing an anti-conspiracy tour. Yeah, it's going to be very interesting, right? We did it on a live show, didn't we, Chris, in Huddersfield? But I've also found some more information. And one of the bits of information is that his direct ancestor was one of the original board members of the Bank of England.
Whoa.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So now we're going back to but anyway, but in there, he went to a school called Haileybury College. Yeah. Which was set up by the East India Company to train people to run the empire.
That's it.
Right. So these schools were done for a particular reason. And
totally.
You know, and anyway, I haven't got anything about these schools. All I'm saying is that it seems to be that these people are trained, but there's a different group of people that are picked out to do certain roles. It seems to be that way at an early age as well. Going back to what we're talking about, the UN having a 100-year plan, it seems to be the similar sort of thing for these individuals.
Totally. And I've got one of the things I noticed is that I think my school was built at the same time as Haileybury. There was a spate of public school building in the 1860s. My school was 1860s.
That mid 1800s line again.
Yeah. So they partly it was to train administrators for the empire. And here's another thing: the most important church service at school was not the Christmas one. I suppose we'd have been at home during Easter, so that wouldn't have counted anyway. But it was the Remembrance Day service. And I think that the real purpose of these, you see war memorials of all the boys who've died, and schools pride themselves on how many boys have been killed in the... And at the time, it seemed, about honouring the dead, honouring sacrifice and stuff. I think that it is actually celebrating, maybe that's too strong a word, but it's inculcating
young men. The inversion again that you're talking about.
We've actually talked about this before, James, on it. That the fact that even where I live in this little village, well, biggest village, there's a...
Where is it again, Chris?
is it anywhere near?
Obelisk.
Or the university town.
Cambridgeshire. There's an obelisk. Well, I live in Trumpington, just outside, but there's an obelisk in every village, isn't there, for World War One veterans? And it's a celebration.
There's one in my village,
It's a celebration of sacrifice. I watched a little bit of that with King Sausage Fingers, and he said sacrifice, these people sacrifice. They didn't sacrifice. They didn't have any choice, did they? They didn't. No one wanted to go and die in a
they
war.
They really... Yeah, I mean, all this stuff about dulce et decorum est pro patria mori, that all the language that they've borrowed, you've got poets, at the going down of the sun, and you've got we had the corps, the CCF parading, we had the bugler on the tower on top of the main building, we had the minutes silence, we had it was a really, really big deal, and I'm thinking what they're doing is they're brainwashing us to become the next officers, to be the first to lead their men over the top, or whatever variant they've got now, the first to be mown down by Olga with her drone in Moscow, and dropping grenades on you,
dropping micro grenades on you.
Yeah, that's what it's going to be like, and we're supposed to suck it up because it's great.
These people are celebrating, and were they brave? They had no choice. So bravery comes from having no choice. That's what they're told. But the officer class, going back to we'll call it the upper class as it was back then, the people, the Earl's sons and the Duke's sons, they were wiped out. They were wiped out.
Which is interesting, isn't it?
Yes.
Given that these are the families, which are the bloodlines families, which run the world, it seems that they are prepared. Part of the deal is, well, actually they do. I mean, they love sacrificing their firstborn and stuff. I mean, that's part of the ritual.
Yeah. And there was a cleansing of, right, we need to get rid of this batch, and now they're going to marry into this batch. A cleansing of the bloodline, if you like, probably.
French Revolution always surprised me in that way, with the bloodline, because they killed off all the aristocracy.
Yeah, but Bonaparte, although there were several of them, although we only ever talk about one of them, but the Bonapartes were royal heritage. Anyway,
no, what I mean is though, like the wars here, where the upper class that you wouldn't think they'd be the victims.
Yeah,
it was a similar thing where they wiped a massive batch out.
They're expected to be victims, really. Even more so than the working class, I would say, because expected to do their duty. Even more so, but like men.
I've said before, they're the Winstons, aren't they, James?
I went to Tresco.
Yeah, that's a good point, Chris. They're the Winstons, aren't they? From 1984.
Where the Proles?
Where the
Proles,
yeah.
Sorry, just distracting. I went to Tresco in the Isle of Scillies. Is it in the Scilly Isles? The other day. And this island has been owned by one family since 1830. They leased it off the Duchy of Cornwall. And I went into the church, and the family that owns the island, one side of the family lost two sons in the Second World War. The other side lost three sons, and two of the cousins were killed on the same day. So that they do seem horrific. These people run the world, and yet they are expected to. I think it's part of the charade, is it? Maybe
Rudyard Kipling. His son didn't have to go into World War One. Because his eyesight or something like that. Ugh. But he bribed, or because he obviously knew people, he bribed him to get him in, and he got whacked in World War One. Rudyard Kipling's son.
He
could have legitimately stayed out of the war.
But Rudyard Kipling was, of course, a Freemason.
Yes.
Because we know from The Man Who Would Be King.
Yeah.
And maybe, do you think maybe that was part of the blood sacrifice deal?
Possibly. I mean, we'll never know this, but I mean, it seems to stack up that all these people are disappearing. In power, would you just constantly send your children, if you had the chance, to go and die in a war that didn't really seem to benefit anybody? Apart from, if you think about, I keep mentioning the Hunger Games, but if you encapsulate the front line, World War One and Two, yeah. It was like a giant Hunger Games, wasn't it?
That must be Dick. Oh, yeah.
Hey, Dick, you all right, mate?
They say he's all right, mate. Look, Dick's brought me a cup of tea.
All right, he's back now, is he?
Yeah. It's probably not strong enough, but...
Three sugars,
yeah? 15 sugars, yeah.
I wish I could hear, but I can't hear a bloody thing.
He can't hear a thing, he's saying. Yeah. I'm translating from, I wish I could hear, but I can't hear a thing.
Yeah. I could sort of hear him. Yeah.
But I was thinking that there would have been a time in my life, thanks to all that brainwashing that we got. I mean, don't forget, you don't just get this at your fancy public school. You get it before, from the age of 8 to 13, at your prep school.
Yeah.
Same old brainwashing. Because, of course, your prep school's got aboard with all the boys that have been slaughtered pointlessly as well.
Yeah.
And you think, I know these boys' names.
Yeah.
Every year, you know, I know the names of the boys who died, not the ones who lived. So these are extra special. And I reckon you develop this mindset where...
What's it called? The ultimate sacrifice.
I want to make the ultimate sacrifice. Yeah, I want to be there. It's cool. You know, I'll live forever in the memory of...
Sounds like a sister dying.
I think the generation now, I don't think they're buying it, though. I think that, like you said, they put that test out there. I don't think they're willing to do that.
I really hope so. But you got me thinking about, you know, because we were speculating earlier, how does the system work? Do people know they're being recruited? Do they know they're evil and they're part of the system? Or are they kind of inveigled into the system? And I think it's a mixture of both. That you think about how public schools operate, you know, that they make you head of house if they think you've got if you're head of house material.
Yeah, but why isn't those prefects and heads of house, what were they? They were the ones that conformed and never did anything wrong.
That's exactly it. What is prefect and head of house material? It's basically being an arse-licking control freak.
I never got that job. I never got any prefect. I always wanted to be, but I never got chosen for anything.
You see, I think this explains a lot about the weird hybrid creature I've become. Because I tended to edge into I just managed to get these positions by the skin of my teeth, not because I was naturally, I had the natural aptitude for it, because I didn't. I was really kind of instinctively mistrusting of authority, and I had it all within me. But at the same time, I was one of the clever kids, and I did well in class, and I got loads of prizes and stuff. And it was like,
this is how you get bought in. Do you get bought? We get bought, don't we?
Yeah, we
just get bought, whether it's from a financial aspect or shiny things or whatever it is. We become magpies chasing these little gizmos and things like that.
I remember from our last discussion, James, that one of the reasons you're now doing what you're doing is because you felt slightly let down that they didn't choose you.
This is my revenge. They wouldn't let me into their big club that I'm not in, so I'm not going to be in it ever.
We're going to touch on, before we finish, we're coming up to that, I know it's gone in this, we're over an hour anyway now, but it's gone very quick. And we should do another one at some point as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. But we were talking before we came on about C.S. Lewis. And because you asked me about Tolkien, didn't you?
I want you to do a deep dive on Tolkien because it's like one of those moments where et tu, Clive Staples, et tu, whatever Tolkien was called. Because These are kind of our white hat hopes, aren't they? That the guys who called out the bad stuff. But we know from your research that Aldous Huxley was not really calling out the bad stuff so much as
controlling the bad stuff.
Promoting it, controlling it. Yeah. And I wonder whether it's the same with those two. So I'd love to know what you find.
Ironically, C.S. Lewis and Tolkien apparently taught George Orwell's first wife at Oxford, Eileen O'Shaughnessy. Gave her lectures. This was before she knew Orwell. She became a psychotherapist, ironically. she had. Did you know, James? Right, she were at a girls' school in Sunderland, and she went back there for their 50th anniversary, and they had to write a story or a poem for what would the school be like in 50 years' time, which turned out to be 1984, 50-year time. So she wrote a poem called 1984, right? And then she met George Orwell and married him, and apparently that's what 1984... She was a psychotherapist at the time, but 1984. So did this start ringing any alarm bells for you?
Well, I mean, was she his kind of MK Ultra controller?
No, I don't...
A lot of them have those kind of wives.
I know we're talking about something totally different, but the links to these people that George Orwell was then schooled by for a semester at Eton by Aldous Huxley.
Yeah.
And so the links to all of these people, which you could say they went to the same school, so they would be linked. But the working relationships, what I haven't found is Orwell and Huxley knew each other. But there's no sort of relationship there. There's no sort of correspondence, which I found quite strange. It's like it's been scrubbed, you know. Surely they'd, if he was both, a famous, both famous, wrote, yeah,
the most dystopian novels famous ever, novels probably of all time, yeah,
yeah. And also, H.G. Wells, his mentor was Aldous Huxley's father, no, grandfather, T.H. Huxley, Thomas Huxley. He was H.G. Wells's mentor.
Was he?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think we came to a semi-conclusion, and I've thought this for a while, that maybe George Orwell didn't actually exist as we know him.
Yeah. Might have been another Paul McCartney.
There's only a handful. If you look, if you Google or image him, there's only a handful of photographs of him. And he worked for BBC Radio, but there's not really any recordings.
There's no recordings of him.
No recordings of him.
Audio, yeah, you see, this is analogous to the Shakespeare thing. You know, a lot of people defending the Shakespeare narrative get very up in arms and they always play the kind of the class victim thing. They say, how dare you suggest that a man educated at a mere grammar school with small Latin and less Greek, according to Boris, according to Ben Johnson, just because he came from the provinces doesn't mean he could use his genius, his imagination to create these. You know, you're a snob, and I won't have it. And the much more compelling reason why we should distrust the narrative that a man from Stratford wrote this stuff is that there is no record of this guy having any relationship with any of the other poets of his day. You know,
just wouldn't happen, would it?
I don't think so.
Was he illiterate, William Shakespeare?
I think his children were, and his parents were.
I think he
couldn't sign his own name.
Yeah, he did have a royal lineage, if that's true. He did have a royal lineage.
But it seems like more like music now is written by committee. It seems like books were written by committee then. You know, like the Darwinian books, the possibly 1984, possibly Aldous Huxley's.
Well, if you look at going back to Orwell and Huxley, they didn't write anything like them first books.
Yes, that's
up
what
to that point. Yeah. That was,
it was a change of tact, wasn't it?
Yeah, a total different direct. A bit like the Beatles writing Love, Love This and Love, Love That. Then all of a sudden, Line in the Sand, as Mike Williams, fantastic research did, showed that, I think it was Revolver, just totally changed. They were like two different bands writing two different songs, sets of songs.
Aldous Huxley was writing about like socialites in...
Orwell was. He would what with Wigan Pier and the
what
he did
like
in Paris
social stuff, wasn't it? Social.
Yeah.
Yes, I think I mean his autobiographical stuff is nothing like I think your instinct is right. I think you could be right. He probably was a kind of a construct.
Because them early books like the Wigan Pier and the Down and Out in Paris, they were almost like journalistic books, weren't they?
Yeah.
Talking about our life when, and all of a sudden we went to Animal Farm and 1984, which was totally out of character.
I mean, Animal Farm's now owned by the CIA, isn't it? They bought the rights to Animal Farm. Eileen O'Shaughnessy worked for the Ministry of Information.
And like we were talking about at the beginning about art and sculpture, there's all these books, but why is it the same like the Tolkien's and the C.S. Lewis? Why are these regurgitated over and over again in films? Over and over and over again. I mean, they even make sequels that never existed now, don't they? And prequels and all sorts of shit.
Yeah.
Matters because nothing gets made or published without their wanting it to happen.
Yeah. Well, Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, obviously, as we know, were best mates or good mates.
Yeah.
And they were both into the dark occult as well. That's a well-known fact, is that they were dark occultists.
Not well known enough to me. Because obviously, a lot of Christians would celebrate C.S. Lewis as the greatest Christian apologist of the 20th century. You know, he wrote Mere Christianity, his wartime lectures on why you should be a Christian. Mm. But I have heard people come up with a counter narrative, which is that they've analysed even his teachings on Christianity, and they say, well, he's not really a proper Christian. So you're saying that.
Well, I'm only going with what.
Have been an ardent Catholic as well.
Yeah, well I'm only going on what.
Is the Pope an ardent Catholic? I would say satanic.
Good point. Yeah. Good point.
Maybe a hard on Catholic. all right, I'll run a scenario. In World War One, they were trained at Sandhurst with a chap, forgetting his name without digging my notes out. And they were probably raw 18-year-olds or something like that. And they made a pact together that they were going to look, if one of them got popped, they were going to look after each other's families, as you would, living together and training together, etc. Now, there's a strong rumour that both of them were homosexual lovers.
Obviously, so we're talking...
C.S. Lewis and this other chap.
Oh, sorry.
I forget his name, right? Sorry. I'll explain myself better. So C.S. Lewis was rooming at Sandhurst, I think it was, with another chap, and they made a pact to look after each other's family. The other chap got popped in the Somme, so it would be 1916, not 18, around that time.
Right.
C.S. Lewis survived, and he went and lived with his mother and this chap's sister. So this chap's mother and this chap's sister.
Yes.
The sister was about 13, 14, I think, or 12, or something like that. And they lived in a place called the Kilns. If you know C.S. Lewis, it's quite a famous house, the Kilns. And his brother lived there with him as well. And he'd been in the army, and there was a story written that Lewis was having an affair with his mate's mother, who got killed in the Somme, who was meant to be looking after. She was about 30 years older than him, etc. But during World War II, a young lady moved in with him called June Flewitt. Yeah, she came as the Blitz was hitting. They evacuated a family, and there was three of them. There was her, a sister, and a brother, I think, that lived there. And her favourite writer had just happened to be C.S. Lewis. Yeah, and she didn't know she was moving in. Yeah, exactly. I mean, she went on to be Jill Reynard, the actress, who then went on to marry Clement Freud.
Oh, really? Right, yeah. Okay.
So there's a whole story behind all it. And she apologised for Clement Freud's the allegations that was made about him being a paedophile, because he was a liberal politician as well.
He was definitely a paedophile.
Well,
they all were.
Yeah. Well, she apologized without even, you know, she didn't even question the allegations after he died. But he was with Cyril Smith and all the other cronies around that time, Ted Heath, etc. That era of people, some horrific stories. So, yeah, the whole story of C.S. Lewis. Anyway, a listener of ours, after she'd come to see us at the live show we did doing C.S. Lewis. And she, like yourself, was a C.S. Lewis fan. I mean, a lot of people are, the stories he wrote and et cetera. So she wrote, the guy that wrote his autobiography, I think he's part of the C.S. Lewis Foundation, which still owns the Kilns house now, famous house. But they lived there, ironically, for 33 years. It's written fact is this, and they paid £33,000 for it back in the 1920s. So, I'm not making this shit up, honestly.
This is just extraordinary.
I know. Sometimes you research stuff and you think, really? A bit like when you did your watermelon stuff. Really? Am I really researching that? Anyway,
yeah.
So he mentioned the possibility of him being a gay lover of the chap he was in the army with, but he'd missed it out of his book. And so she questioned this guy who'd written about it. And he said, oh, it wasn't the story that that was important. And she went, and about June Flewitt. Yeah, she hadn't mentioned that. He hadn't mentioned that. He said, oh, it wasn't the story that in there that was important. I'm thinking, really? Even the fact that she went on to marry Clement Freud and part of the Freud family, she became Lady Freud and all this type of stuff. And she runs now a charity and also, that's not important. That's not. Yeah, so anyway. So now we know it's not important. He's writing for the C.S. Lewis. We know it's important, don't we?
That is really interesting. I'm struck by how many influential figures from that era, actually even to the present day, are closet homosexuals.
Yes. Especially today. It doesn't matter, does it, today? I don't mean nobody cares. I mean, our generation, our age group, got over that part a long time ago. We, you know, everybody's, if you're gay, great. I used to go to clubs and gay clubs and you didn't care, you know, when you were out dancing the light, fantastic, you know, and nobody cared. You know, you go to your club, we'll go to ours, but we'll join some at some point and have a laugh.
But the city,
We got the gist, whoever Orwell was, whether it changed from Eric Blair to George Orwell, and that's the line in the sand, like the McCartney story. We got the gist that most of Orwell's friends were homosexual, or at least played both sides of the fence.
Yeah, yeah.
And which is, I can't say it's unusual or usual, but it's unusual that all of your friends, or the majority of your friends, would be gay.
If you were straight. It was a compromising tool. Yeah. It was a compromising tool, whereas now it's not a compromising tool, is it? You've got to be
It's not just a compromising tool. It's also a club. I mean, an actual preference. So Winston Churchill used to go on jollies, didn't he, to Tangier, and places to sleep with rent boys during the war. Jimmy Savile was probably the procurer of boys for people like
Mountbatten,
exactly, and others who are still alive. We probably can't.
Yeah.
They seem to have wives for public appearances, and boys for for preference.
Well, Orwell's wife died in strange circumstances. She got ill very quickly and died under the surgeon's knife or after an operation very quickly. And bear in mind, she's working for the intelligence unit. She's working for the Ministry of Information during World War II, the basically propaganda arm of British government. And his second wife was an odd character as well. His second wife was even more. George Orwell's second wife, Sonia Barnwell or something like she was called, Sonia Orwell or Sonia Blair, whichever word she's using. Can you remember that story, Chris, where she was in Switzerland? She was at a convent. She was in Switzerland and they went boating in a lake. And there were two boys, two girls on a boat in a lake in Switzerland. One of the boys fell in. And she told a story where he tried to pull her in, so she had to hold his head underwater and basically killed him.
Yeah, weird, that, wasn't it?
It was a strange story. That is
a weird story, and not one you'd want to tell.
But she did tell it. She told it in a mainstream.
But that's what I mean. You know what?
I think it was Tatler. I think it was Tatler. I read that in. He
was dragging her down, so she drowned him.
Yeah. And this was George Orwell's second wife. The amount of things that have never happened in your life, my life, and Chris's life altogether. We haven't had one of those type of weird things happen to it. You know.
And this is. This is another okay. So there was a, going back to that thing about why I never got admitted to the charm circles. I wonder whether I was just simply not kind of.
You've been analysed, mate. Psychoanalysed.
Yeah, I'm just not fucked up enough.
You might have a bit too much empathy there, James.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. And I was thinking that this goes on throughout life. When I went into journalism, I remember they would often give you what I realize now were shit tests. So they would ask you to do a story about a friend or to shop, you know, use your acquaintance with somebody to get in and under their skin and expose them or do whatever. Or they would give you, there's that famous one, you know, where trainee reporters on local newspapers used to be given the job of having to go around doorstepping families whose child had recently died. And you're thinking, well, what actually is the point of that? Whose interests are being served here? Nobody's interests are being served, but you are being given a humiliation ritual which demonstrates your ability to unquestioningly obey orders and your ability to overcome your squeamishness about doing things
That's basically jump out of that trench and run into those machine gun bullets pointlessly. In journalism,
I think that every trade, every industry has these shit tests at an early age. And what they're really doing is selecting for the psychopathy, which will later be of advantage to them. That was a digression.
I think it's look
at The Apprentice, the TV show. That's what that was, wasn't it? They were basically used to, not that I watched.
Well,
it a lot,
it's changed business, Chris. Dragon's Den, The Apprentice.
On each other, yeah.
It's changed how people do business. It has.
Yeah. In the same way that I'm a Celebrity was designed to train people to get used to the idea of eating bugs.
Yes. Yeah.
They can sometimes be so.
Well, it's boring. It's boring. It's that blatant, isn't it? That's the thing now. But going back to Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, Tolkien will play a part, as will H.G. Wells in this Huxley stuff. It'll just unfold on its own. I know. Tolkien will play a part because it is obviously linked with C.S. Lewis. And I haven't done the C.S. I've only done. There's different levels when you do research. So you do like a surface look, see if there's anything interesting there.
Yeah.
And then when you find a couple of things, I'll just look through there. And then it depends on, as you know, when you wrote your Watermelons book, it depends what you find when you're digging down. And all of a sudden you might find this treasure trove of information, of different information that will lead you off in a different direction. So I haven't got into C.S. Lewis like that yet.
Here's a tidbit that can help you go down that particular rabbit hole. I heard from somebody, occasionally I deal with people who are involved in the world of the occult, the satanic, you know, the Mothers of Darkness and stuff. And I can't remember who it was who told me, or maybe I just read it, that all the bloodlines, the bloodlines families, you know, people who are deep into the kind of satanic Luciferian shit, they all have Lord of the Rings, and they all it's one of their core texts. In the same way that a Christian might have a Bible, these people absolutely have it, take it really seriously.
Yeah.
Which makes me wonder whether, I mean, we know that Harry Potter was probably written by, well, possibly not written by.
No, she wrote a napkin in a.
Yeah, no, sorry. I'm right. No, you're right. We should go through the press cuttings because they would tell us that she.
Yeah. Look at the tea leaves.
She couldn't afford the heating, apparently.
Yeah, yeah.
So she had to get. She had
single
to
mother.
Go to
a single mother. Yeah.
Single mother.
How many times that's used in a single mother? Yeah.
She's done well for herself,
but,
hasn't
but
she?
What a brilliant way, though, James. If that's true, what you just said about the Lord of the Rings, what a brilliant thing to get encourage everyone to read.
The inversion again, isn't it? Yeah.
Make numerous films about it, and then make, like I said, make sequels that never exist.
It's a bit like the Fleming family, isn't it? Ian Fleming, right? Wrote James Bond. He, obviously, people know that he was in the intelligence units during World War II.
Yeah.
But what a lot of people don't realize is that his family owned Fleming Bank.
Right.
That sold out for $7 billion to Chase Manhattan a few years ago. So that family, Flemings, were in the upper echelons of merchant banking with all the usual suspects going back way before Ian Fleming thought about writing James Bond. But he was a wayward character at school. I think he went to, he was at Oxford, weren't he, at one point, I think. I might be wrong there, might be Cambridge. I mean, he was one of them anyway. But he was sent by his mother because he was a bit wayward. He was a bit of a ladies' man and all that type of stuff. And she sent him, me and Chris did this in one of the Huxley ones, she sent him, because she wanted him to go into the Foreign Office, and she sent him to Kitzbühel in Austria. Remember Kitzbühel because I was skiing there. But and it was a private school run by a former British spy, right?
Right.
And his novelist wife. And this woman did psychology on him. And I've got my notes open here, so I'm going to read out what he said. He says, "My life with both of you is one of my most cherished memories, and heaven knows where I should be today without you." Basically, he was there, and he came back a different person, apparently.
He was recruited. So what age was this?
It was in 1927, so I don't know what age it was. It was...
Early,
because he was wayward, and his mother, going back to that the Flemings are one of these families you're talking about with the Lord of the Rings books, possibly. I'm not saying he had, but, yeah. So, the Fleming family, and, yeah.
They select very early, don't they?
Well, this, again, going back to the types of people that they select, there will be, even back then, analysing people who they... I mean, I've started writing a presentation about Hitler being an MKUltra prospect as well.
Oh, and he was probably an illegitimate Rothschild as well, wasn't he, I think?
Well, quite possibly. I don't know about that. But he, after World War One, he definitely went in for hypnosis. Yeah. When he got injured in World War One, and he was the only one chosen to go for this new treatment that were hypnosis treatment. Guy's written a book about it. It's interesting, very interesting book. He's not on our side of the fence either. He's from academia, and he, funnily enough, the doctor that gave him this hypnosis training started talking about it during the 1930s, and was sort of. Died suddenly in Paris when it was under Nazi rule. Yeah. So I would hazard a guess that this MKUltra type, mind-changing, whatever you want to call it, technology or processing, has been going on for a long time.
I think so. Well, please can you do a deep dive sometime into, also, Louis Pasteur.
Louis Pasteur, yeah.
And also Edward Jenner.
Yeah. Well, these people are going to come up. I'll tell you why they're going to come up. Because once the Huxley stuff, it'll veer off into health and everything. It's like the gift that keeps giving. Just not enough time, man. That's
no,
the problem.
Can you imagine what the book would look like?
Yeah.
The grand universal history of conspiracy characters.
Yeah, I know. I think Mark Devlin says that most of these things are very close to a Huxley. It's very rare before you find a Huxley. Just before we finish, James, right?
Yeah.
We were talking about Crowleys.
Yes.
Weren't we, before we started?
We were.
And we keep digging, falling over two Crowleys, don't we, Chris? We found one, I forget what his first name. One we're called Nathan. What's the other one?
Nathan's the one who my missus found.
Yes.
And the other one.
I'll find the other one. You tell the story about the one your missus found.
Was it Chris Crowlock?
No, I'll find it. You crack on. Tell the other one.
Well, no, so basically, James, my missus was, she works for a estate agent, but she, they were at some, like, you know.
It's meeting. Not just an estate agent.
Well, I'm not going to tell who it is.
No, is it? Yeah.
So she worked for, who do, like, you know, they do everything to architecture, landscape and everything. And they were at some, like, work meeting, and they had speakers, guest speakers. One guest speaker on went off, and when he went off, he had the Sgt. Pepper album cover on the screen. The next guy who came on, I think that was Nathan, wasn't it, that year?
Yeah.
He came on and he went, "Oh, that's one of my relatives," and pointed at Alistair Crowler. He was called Nathan Crowler. Anyway, when it finished, my missus went, I wonder if it was Alistair Crowler. And then when he was leaving, she said he went into a lift and she ran after him. She went, "Which one are you related to?" And he went, "Oh, yeah, Alistair Crowler." Anyway, and the whole meeting was about basically how to manipulate people and, you know, in business and get them doing what you want them to do, etc. Anyway, we dug into it a little bit because my missus got very excited and firm. Dug into a little bit, and she was the one that helped Boris get into mayorship. And he worked for a company that helped Boris get into mayorship and a PR company.
Nathan Crowley is the guy that works with Nolan, yeah. Yeah.
Which one is it? What's his name?
I'll find out who he is, yeah.
Anyway. And he also got David Cameron into prime ministership, and he helped.
He was part of the Ministry of Sound.
Yeah,
was it? Well, they're dodgy as that the Palumbo connection.
Yeah, Baron Palumbo. Yeah.
James Palumbo.
Yeah. Well, I remember that we were. You know, I remember the dance scene, and I remember the Ministry of Sound up there. I remember going quite early on, and it was a different monster to everywhere else. It was very strict,
dark, corporate.
Yeah, it was very corporate.
It was.
Yeah, corporate. That's the word. Yeah.
Yeah.
More than any of the other ones that I'd ever been to. Almost, yeah, just a strange place.
He was called Alex Crowley, Chris. Alex Crowley, OBE, yeah.
Yeah.
And he was, yeah, on his, in
the
his bio.
He's got, yeah.
Yeah, on his bio, he actually says he changes people's mind. You know, he actually says all this, you know. He doesn't fuck about, you know what I mean? But he's a very jovial character as well. He's not sort of like...
Oh, he would be.
Don't come across as a dark art type character, you know what I mean?
Well, my missus said, "Oh, you're still talking about that. He was really nice." I'm like, "Oh, whatever. Yeah. It's not the point, is it?"
It says here, this is his bio: "I've helped to get a prime minister elected, convince thousands of local residents to back airport expansion, mobilise hundreds of thousands of consumers to put pressure on regulators, produce compelling video content and directed live broadcasts at venues like Wembley Arena." Yeah.
Yeah, I really wish that I could go back into my old world when I still sort of rub shoulders with these people, knowing what I know now. The problem is that I couldn't do it now. A, because they wouldn't let
me
near
them. Would they?
But B, because I would be giving off these vibes. I wouldn't be able to help it. That
I found another one recently, actually. let me just explain this one as well, though.
Yeah, yeah.
I told you this the other day. I don't, you know, Alan Moore, the comic book artist, he wrote Watchmen, etc. Yeah. I was just flicking through. I don't know if you know. He wrote a book called From Hell, which I'd highly recommend. Actually, if you read it now, I mean, it's a comic book
about the Ripper.
Yeah, about the Ripper. But the appendix in the back, he's got all his research into it, which I've always meant. I've just started reading it again. I mean, I read the book years ago, but it's got Masons in it. It's got everything in it. You know, the fact that I think he declares that the Ripper was the Queen's surgeon and she asked him to do it and all this stuff. So it's got a lot of stuff like that. Anyway, I was reading some of the appendix and they were talking about how. There's a bit in the beginning where he gets the guy who drives the car, he gets him to drive him around London and he pinpoints all these different areas, St. Paul's Cathedral, etc. Anyway, he joins them all together at the end and it's a hex. It's the, you know, the literally into a hex. So I was reading the appendix about that bit because I always thought it was interesting. And in it, he says he went to St. Paul's Cathedral and some guy in there showed him that they had a stone that was an original from the the Solomon's Temple. And then he says at the end in this appendix, he says, and by the way, I was looking around here with, he names one guy, and then another guy was Mike Crowley. And I'm like, it's got to be, because Alan Moore is a known Crowley. He's a known Crowley, isn't it?
Is he?
Yeah, he is. He's a known black, he's a known magician.
Right.
He's actually a magician. He's a magician. A dark magician, yeah.
I mean, I love Alan Moore's comics. I used to be a big comic book reader, you know, turned into numerous films. But again, I always found it funny with his adaptations into films, because he wrote V for Vendetta, he wrote Watchmen, From Hell, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen. I don't know if you've seen that.
But yeah,
he always denounced the film version, saying that they bought the rights off him and he didn't know the comic book publishers had sold them rights. But then From Hell was virtually self-published, but he still slagged off the film version. I always thought that was quite curious, if you know what I mean. So he must have sold the rights to it. But he's not only a Crowley fan, he's possibly knocking around with a Crowley...
Relative,
yeah.
I don't think that you are a Crowley fan and on our side. I'm sorry.
No, you can't be.
No.
He talks about drinking baby's blood and stuff. You can't be, can you?
No.
He
I've never done
himself
that.
As the evilest man on the planet.
So there's a third one that we came across, which is even probably more influential than, well, I don't know if he is or isn't, but he's very influential, let's just say. That's a guy called Nathan Crowley. Chris keeps coming across these ones. It's not me at all. And Nathan Crowley is a production designer for film. So he basically works on all Christopher Nolan's films.
Does he?
Right. And he does all the production design. And I don't know if you've seen the video that I did of with Sir Julian Huxley at the beginning, where he shows the pedigree of how they... He shows a family that have all got mental defectives in them, as he calls it. And then he's got the actors, and he shows all the pedigree of the actors, and the Terry family and the Gielgud's and all these, and shows how... And the set designers in there and all the... It's calling them geniuses and stuff like that. Yeah. And then when you think that you've got a Crowley who's set designing all the massive films like Braveheart, going back to Braveheart and all the Batman films and whatever. Yeah, Wonka is just a Wonka. He didn't do Oppenheimer because he was working on Wonka. I mean, Wonka the dark film.
Yeah, yeah.
Even the one in the 60s, which were fantastic, the late 60s with Gene Wilder, that was still a dark film if you watch it, really, with a different through different eyes. He's doing all the set design. And Chris always says that it only takes one of these people to suggest something and leave it in. You know, when you watch a film back and you see these signs in there that you didn't even notice.
Yes, well, I've often wondered this. Because they all have them, and they're replete with occult symbols.
The production designer would be the key guy to do it, wouldn't it?
Of course it would.
Yeah.
You know, I've held Aleister Crowley's wand.
Have you?
Because it so there was an author, 1930s author called Henry Green, whose real family, or have I got the wrong way around? Anyway, the real name is York, and the writer's name is Green, or vice versa. And I went to the big house owned by his cousin, whatever, and they've got this collection of stuff that, because Aleister Crowley was used to come to this house, and I held his wand.
So why? I mean, first question is, why would a family have a collection of Aleister Crowley's stuff? Isn't it? And now you look back, yeah.
But they'd have it because, in a way, come into the Crowley room now.
Yeah.
And this is where
Crowley.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
See, you never know whether these people are still into dark magic or whether it's just an anecdote thing. Yeah. And it's just like, because for these people, it's normal to move in these circles. They've all got the rackety,
interesting, isn't it? It's very interesting, man.
It is
very. How have you? One last question before we leg it. How's thinking like this affected your? We asked these to a few people. Affected your life with like family and friends? I know you and your dick obviously are all right, fine.
I mean, nightmare.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
I bet the watermelons book affected you. You know, it slightly, didn't it?
That sort of cut me adrift slightly, but I was still adrift in a bay. Whereas now I'm adrift in the open seas.
Yeah.
Just like,
one order and a paper hat.
Although, yeah, do you know, weirdly, I got given this commission the other day. Somebody said, you know, James, can you do us a piece on blah, blah, blah? And this is the first journalistic commission I've had in 4 years. I just don't get asked to write stuff anymore. And this turned out to be a fellow journalist from back in the day, who she said, oh, by the way, I've been listening to your pods and I do
really
agree with you. And right. So the only other person I've met from my past who's gone down, who's arrived where we are, which is weird, isn't it? I mean,
all them clever people that are, I mean, these people are highly intelligent. It's not, we're not talking of, I mean, but then that measures intelligence in a different way, doesn't it? Intelligence isn't measured with diplomas or what have you.
Cleverness is really, really, really overrated. At least in the traditional definition of...
It's made memorization, I always think. I'm saying that because I never got any qualifications.
No, I think it is. It goes
back to what we said about prefix earlier as well.
It totally is. I'm sorry that I was prefect. Well, I like to think I was a shit prefect. I like to think I really, really,
Does it really matter who we were? It's who we are.
True.
To a point of, obviously, you know, there's a line in the sand of who we could be. But what I'm trying to say is, this is where we are now. This is who we are. This is where we've grown to.
Yes.
You had to come from a place. I was going to join the army after I left school. I look back now and go, you know.
The dark side is that if you're at school, and I wasn't very academic, I only did well in art. You're basically told if you're not academic that you're worthless, aren't you? Outly like that, or just made to feel that you're not going to get anywhere in life. You know?
Yeah, yeah. I thought all you had to do to be successful was listen to Rocky music.
It's not lying, Ivory did.
Just watch Rocky and you'll be successful. Yeah. All right, then we'll leave it there. I'd like to thank you, James, for joining us. Hopefully, we'll do it at some point soon. When we get a moment again. Yeah.
Great to see you again, James.
Okay, great to see you again, Chris. We'll do another.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever you want.
Well, if you're joining us for part two, we'll see you there. If not, we'll see you next week.
Bye.